Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Today, Richard and I, again, are answering emails. Let's get started. Actually, contradicting myself, before we get started, we had a recent show with Small Cap, and who had, we'll call them gambling addiction issues. And we have received more positive emails on that particular show than I remember receiving in a while. A lot of people, it touched home, whether for them personally or somebody they know, and it's not a smooth sale.
You know, ever since I first started, I had friends who were professional gamblers who used to say there is a fine line between a professional gambler and a degenerate. The difference is we have an advantage when we play, but there are often some of those same parts of people's personality that feed into both. So anyway, I wish him well. He's always been very entertaining. I personally get a lot of response from people whenever he's on the show, but I too got response from people saying it was nice for that to be addressed because it's something we really don't talk about very often.
Yeah, it is nice to pretend it doesn't exist, but it does.
You know, I have to say, the reason that I quit playing backgammon was because to be a successful backgammon player who's trying to make money at the game, not in tournaments, but in cash games, the way to make more money was to seek out people who had gambling problems because they were going to throw their money away. And I just found it really distasteful after a while, and that was a big part of me stopping playing that game.
Yeah, even if they didn't have problems, it's like you're sitting face to face with somebody who's losing. It's different with the casino where you win a couple $1,000s and the casino has pretty big pockets. But in backgammon, you're sitting across the board from somebody and you watch the way he pulls out $2,000 from his wallet and he has to go explain that to his wife or something. And this is an issue.
Yeah, yeah. It's very personal. Even in poker, you know, there might be eight other guys there or whatever. But in backgammon, it's you and one guy, or sometimes it's Chouette. But yeah, it is. It's personal.
In poker, though, for the most part, they have their chips already. And so it's chips and not pulling cash out of their wallet. It's different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, somebody asked a question that I've answer numerous times, and I'll answer it again. It's, what's the protocol for tipping floor personnel and or host in video poker? And the answer is whatever you want. Everybody has their own suggestion as to what the rules are. I like the Rita Rudner explanation, that where she said if she hit a jackpot, she'd start to pay the money, and if they looked really sad, she would pay them some more, and if they started to look happy, she'd take some back. So that was always my favorite explanation of it. I tend, at the South Point, I will tip, because they host my classes and sponsor the radio show. And I don't want complaints about my lack of tipping to get up to the slot director and Mr. Gone and the GM. But at many casinos, I don't tip at all. And I play a lot at Dottie's, which is a small place with like 15 machines, and there's basically one bartender in every machine, every place. There I tip. In these places, there's no pooling of tips. You he keeps what he gets. And your life is a lot easier in a really small place if you're tipping. So, do you tip at all, Richard?
Yeah, especially on table games. Not when I'm counting cards, which I really don't do anymore and haven't for many, many years, but because the edge is too small, and no matter what you give them, they're not going to be happy with it. But when I'm playing a game with a much bigger edge, then I do tip and tip fairly a lot, often because the dealer can, without even knowing it, affect the game when you're playing some of these other things. And you, in many cases, you want to keep the dealer happy because the game, it may mess up the game inadvertently. You know, casinos forever, when players are winning, they try to do things to stop them from winning, right? So when I was a, first started dealing 40 years ago, they would tell you, change the way you shuffle the cards. And I've run into that around the world. You start winning in Korea and suddenly they change the way they shuffle the cards. Now,
which makes a lot of sense if you were shuffle tracking.
Right. Now, they don't do it because they think of shuffle tracking. They do it because they think they're changing the luck. But sometimes they can accidentally do something that actually ruins the game. Sometimes they make the game better. I've certainly run into that where they changed the way they were shuffling and suddenly the game got dramatically better because of what they had done. The same thing happens in roulette. If somebody starts winning at roulette, they change the speed of the wheel, they change the speed of the ball, they switch which ball they're using. And again, sometimes that actually can affect what you're doing and ruin the game. So same thing can happen with dealers in blackjack or carnival games. And so tipping often helps either make the game better or keep the game alive where the dealer could inadvertently shut it down without even knowing it. Conversely, when I first started playing, we used to play what were called tells. The dealers would look at their hole cards so they knew whether they were stiff or not. And
would look at their hole cards when there was an ace up or a 10
or up. Or a 10, yes. And some dealers, you actually wanted them to be mad at you because the tells became very pronounced. Some of them were ridiculous. I mean, they would look at their hole card, and if they were stiff, they would make a face because they knew that they might bust, and they hated to see you win. And those dealers, you wanted them mad at you. So, you know, you were betting $500, and you get some odd amount, $475, and you end up getting the $250, right? And you put the 50-cent piece out in front of your $500 bet and say, this is for you, you know? So, yeah, it would depend on the situation. But yes, I do tip a lot when the game calls for it.
All right. Changing subjects. Some guy wants to sell us a game. He calls it the best blackjack machine on earth. He doesn't tell us. He gives us some hints in here as to where it might be, but I'm not going to do that on the air. But it's a blackjack machine, single deck, stand on soft 17, double 9, 10, 11, split one time. May hit on split aces. Any six-card hand is an automatic winner for the player. Any six-card dealer hand is a stand.
And is he sure that the blackjack pays 3-2? That would be my first question, because a lot of these blackjack games pay even money.
He says he's calculated that the return for the game is between 100.14% and 100.16%. So,
I know he thinks that it does pay 3-2, but that would be the first thing I would want to check.
And he also says on what he's calculated, in 2017, he ran three times that for the whole year. So I would think that would be pretty clear that it was 3-2. So he, if we're interested in buying it, he will, if we can agree on a price, he'll meet us there and explain all the intricacies of it.
Well, my first question is, why does he want to sell it? If he played it all year, why does he want to sell it? I mean, now, if he played it and won a lot of money and got barred, it seems to me there might be heat on that machine now, and the machine might be gone before we even got there. But in general, I am unwilling to just pay for a game to somebody that I don't know. It just, is, to me, is not a good idea. You know, the game could be gone. You could get barred immediately. There are just lots of things that could go wrong. Now, if this was a friend of mine, if this was somebody I knew and had a history with, well, then I would make some kind of arrangement for a percentage of the win or something like that.
Yeah, I definitely have paid finder's fees to people I know, but not with people I don't know. So I'm willing to offer a very round number for this information, and I assume my round number is not sufficient to learn exactly where it is. So if any of our listeners really want to know this and want to tell them that they're willing to offer, you know, $30,000 for this information, what should be our fee, Richard, when we pass this along? What do you think? I think we ought to move on.
Yeah.
Okay. Our listener plays Double Deck with Amazing Penetration at blah, blah, blah. And he spreads from table minimum, which is $25, all the way up to two hands at 250 if the count gets positive enough. When it comes to playing six deck, he spreads from $5 to two hands of 300. He's only experienced very minimal heat from the bosses. And should he start playing more aggressively until the heat comes, he uses a high-low count and can count down a deck in less than 20 seconds.
If he has the bankroll, I mean, you are going to get barred. Guaranteed. Eventually, that is going to happen. Should you bet more aggressively if you have the bankroll? I guess, why not? I mean, there is some, every casino has some number that makes them nervous. So I remember playing in a casino where the maximum bet was $1,000. And if you bet table max, they had to call the eye in the sky and the shift manager. So I was betting two hands of 900, and a boss walked by, and he kind of did a double take, and he said, "Is that 1,000? I said, "No, it's 900. And he said, "Oh, okay, because if it's 1,000, I have to call the boss in the eye." I said, "Oh, okay, well, I never bet that much." So two hands of 900 is okay, but one hand of 1,000, you got to call the boss. And what was funny was, in that same casino, the limit on one of the carnival games was $50. And if you bet $50, they had to call the shift boss in the eye. So casinos do crazy things. I have no idea why they've let you play as long as you have, but make hay while the sun is shining. Eventually, you will get barred.
Okay. Same guy. He says he wants to take his game to the next level, but he hasn't been able to link up with a serious team, yet alone serious players. He's tried training two close friends, but they don't make training a priority. He owned a business in California for 5 years and sold it to a fellow owner at another location. Now he's in law enforcement and have 3 days off in a week and then 4 days off the next week, so I'm able to practice and play a ton. He's also only 25 years old, so playing hours upon hours usually isn't an issue.
Wow, this is kind of amazing. So he owned a business, now he's in law enforcement, and he's been playing up to $500 a hand or whatever,
and he's only
25 years old. So you're a hard worker and an ambitious guy.
Now, he said he hasn't been able to meet anybody, and he wants to get on a team.
Yeah, well, you know, all the players that I know meet other players in two ways. You either just bump into them on the table, and often you end up sort of meeting in the bathroom or out in the parking lot and saying, hey, you know, and you kind of strike up a conversation. I know many players that have met many other players in exactly that way. The other way that I've met players is on the internet. I would go on the blackjack forums, and you see who's posting, you see who seems to make sense and who the idiots are. Often it's very apparent. And, you know, you strike up conversations with people that way, especially in the chat rooms. That's how you meet them. And definitely you do want to meet other players. You, even if you don't end up teaming up with them, meeting other players, talking to other players, you end up sharing information and you learn things about the game that might take a lot longer to learn if you just try to discover it on your own. You know, I may have said this on the air before, but the way that I approached whatever I did, whether it was backgammon or blackjack, whatever, the first thing I did was I tried to read every book I could find on the subject. And the second was to go out and find players who were better than myself and meet and learn from them. And, you know, I think that's a good approach. And so, yeah, you want to try to meet other players. Eventually it'll happen if you work at it.
It will. And you, Richard, are relatively gifted at your ability to network with others. You have social skills that many others don't. And so for you, it has been relatively easy to meet other players, whereas for some people, it's kind of hard.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to make the effort.
All right. Another question. What is the life of an AP like now? What other businesses do they get involved with? Are most in it for life or just a short period of time?
You want me to go first?
And maybe last.
Well, it's both. Some people are in it for a short period of time. Definitely the people who start out losing a lot in the beginning, many of those people end up quitting and getting out of it entirely. There are a few of us who sort of are diehards, I guess, who can't leave it alone. But not a lot. I mean, most of the guys that I started playing with 40 years ago or whatever have gone on to other things. There are a few of us that still play. A lot of them go into other forms of gambling, sports betting, horse racing. Some go into the financial markets. So, yeah, people go into all sorts of different things. But I think the lessons you learn in gambling stay with you whatever else you go into. Looking for expected value, dealing with variance, understanding that you have to bet with an edge. Those things.
Those are important lessons. And
yeah, absolutely.
There have been people who've hired ex-gamblers because of that training. And we have a financial advisor in here in Las Vegas, and I said I'm absolutely not looking for a job, but if I wanted one, you know, with all the economics and stuff that the almost PhD level way back when, and I could probably be an asset to your company. And would you consider hiring me if I wanted one? And he said, absolutely not. He said, somebody who has been that close to the gambling And whenever they see a good opportunity, is likely going to want to go gamble again. He says, if I want you to put in 40 or 50 hours at my place, I don't want you putting in 10 or 15 hours a day when you go home at a gambling situation, because the opportunity is there and then just come out totally zonked the next day. So,
yeah, but when I first started playing backgammon, I hung out at a bridge club in Chicago, and there were a lot of options traders who played bridge and backgammon who were there at the Cavendish, and they would recruit young players to go become options traders. That was a kind of a common place to recruit.
And actually, I got my first job because I was a gambler. Back around 1980, I had been a backgammon player. And after, and I did fine as long as it was a real popular game and there's all these new people coming in. But when the new people all lost enough money and stayed away, and the only people left were people like Richard and the other people who were better than me, I basically needed to go out and find a job. And so I had been a Fortran programmer in graduate school on economic projects and stuff. And so I figured, well, hell, I could learn COBOL. So I read a COBOL How to Do It book. And went out and started interviewing for COBOL jobs as a programmer. And the first place I interviewed, one of the guys really wanted to hear blackjack stories about where I was in Vegas and what did I think about his system. So a 45-minute interview, we talked about blackjack in Vegas. And the other guy was, he was an amateur backgammon player, and I, of course, was head and shoulders over him. I was not good enough to play with the big boys, but I was way better than him. So we talked about various backgammon strategies and stuff. And they go, well, you're clearly well qualified for this. We don't have any computer programmer jobs, but, you know, can you be a systems analyst? So I said, sure, piece of cake. And I had no idea what a systems analyst was, but they were offering $10,000 more than I was asking for. So I became a systems analyst and lasted that job for 3 years simply because I had a gambling background. It was a one in a million shot, but it worked.
You know, I found that I auditioned a lot of actors over the years. And the key to those auditions, which is the same as any job interview, is being memorable and finding common ground to talk about. So, yeah, I can easily see where if you had stuff that they were interested in to talk about, then that was going to give you a big leg up in getting the job. I still remember, you know, I used to teach an acting class, and I would tell the actors, there's a section on resumes for actors called special skills. And what you actually can do, if you can juggle or speak Spanish, any of that is really irrelevant. But the important point is, if you can have some special skill that is going to make them, when you walk in the door, go, it says you have a special skill. And I still remember to this day, a guy came in and his special skill was pushing Orson Welles' wheelchair. Right? And he had a job pushing Orson Welles around in a wheelchair. Now, anybody in the film business is going to want to hear about that, right?
Yeah.
So that was my example to actors of what you should try to put on your special skills.
Uh-huh.
Now, don't put that if you didn't actually push Orson Welles' wheelchair. But I remember another guy had, I do Donald Duck in Spanish. So he could talk like Donald Duck in Spanish.
Well, I think I could do Fred Flintstone's Yabba Dabba Doo in Spanish, but I think it comes out like Yabba Dabba Doo. But I don't know. Okay. Here's a question for you, Richard. It seems a listener was playing blackjack and he stood up to play. The dealer told him he couldn't play that way. He had to either sit at the table or leave. The dealer didn't know why that was the rule, but that was the rule. So, Richard, do you know?
Yes, it is the rule because casinos are stupid. And what's funny is if you polled the bosses, I'll bet most of them would not know why they have this rule. The purpose of the rule originally was if someone was marking the cards and the dealer was dealing a pitch game, the dealer often holds the deck up too high for you to see the top of the cards so that you could see the marks on the cards. So the player who was marking the cards would stand up in order to be able to see the top of the deck. Now, they have this rule in casinos where they're dealing all the cards face up. The player never touches the cards. And if he wanted to see the card, he'd be better off sitting down in the second seat where the card would be 12 inches away from his nose in the shoe. But some guy somewhere remembers that this was a rule, and so he's instituted it because, well, that's the way we've always done it.
All right.
And again, you know, this is one of my pet peeves, but casinos just forget that they're supposed to be a service business, right? You're supposed to be making your customers happy. And another one that drives me crazy is no taking pictures at the table. Why? Right? I mean, you want young people are all over Instagram and Facebook and posting pictures. Look at the good time I'm having in this casino. And you're telling them, don't take any pictures. It's insane. You should be asking them to take pictures and put them on Instagram and Facebook saying, look at what a good time I'm having at this casino. So,
but if a particular celebrity was having a real good time with a woman, not his wife, and they wouldn't want a picture taken of that.
Well, that was the thinking 50 years ago, right? Vegas was seen as sort of a shady place, and people didn't want to be seen gambling because there was some stigma. But it's the 21st century. I mean, is anybody really stigmatized about gambling anymore? I don't know. If I ran the circus, that was my favorite Dr. Seuss book. If I ran the circus, you would be encouraged to take pictures in the casino and at the table, and there would be charging stations at the table so you could charge your phone while you played, and you could talk on your phone, and you could text, and all of those things. And you would have a good time and play longer, and maybe you would stay longer and lose more money that way.
So there's a chance you're not going to be running the circus, though, this week.
That's true.
Okay. Frequently, somebody has heard you say, Richard, that the first step to becoming a card counter is to memorize basic strategy backwards and forwards.
And in your sleep.
Wouldn't simply using a basic strategy card help the beginner make sure basic strategy is being followed and possibly provide some level of cover against heat?
Yeah. It's not cover. There is no cover. There is no cover. You are not going to fool them. When your bet goes up, when the count is up, they have software that tells them that you're counting cards. They don't. The software doesn't know that you're trying to pretend to be an idiot with a basic strategy card on your table. Yeah, if you want to use a card until you learn basic strategy, then sure, why not? But don't think that you're going to actually start counting cards until you know basic strategy backwards and forwards and in your sleep. If I wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, do you split nines against a two? You better know the answer.
It depends on what game. And what are you doing in my bedroom? Someone has heard several people describe Vegas as a wasteland and a bad place to play. He's also heard it described as a good place to play with a small bankroll. He's currently devising a plan to play with a smaller spread and a smaller EV at my local casino and make a few trips a year to Vegas with a very aggressive hit-and-run strategy at a 1 to 20 spread. Am I wasting my time planning for such a strategy? What are your thoughts on playing in Vegas?
No, I don't think you're wasting your time. The benefit of Las Vegas is there's lots and lots of casinos. The bad part about Las Vegas is they are very quick to catch you as a card counter, and they will flyer you, send your picture around to the other casinos. So I think that's a fine strategy to do a hit and run and just keep moving. It involves a lot of walking, a lot of shoe leather. You'll get a lot of exercise, which is also a good thing. But I don't see anything wrong with that plan at all. I think that's a fine plan.
When we did this last July, there was a question on post office box. And we got a response. It was actually posted on gamblingwithanedge.com by Mr. Yuck, who is a former blackjack ball winner. Richard and I both know him. And
he's been on the show.
He has been on the show. And so I want to read what he wrote. He said, "I want to offer further comment on the post office box question as it relates to the decision to play as a local or an out-of-town guest. I found that most casinos outside of Nevada have one batch of marketing which doesn't make a distinction between local and out-of-town offers. This often means that local hotel rooms are offered for people who live within 5 miles of the casino, and they also send offers which must be collected twice a week to somebody living 500 miles away. The difference between local versus out-of-state is usually not my reason for wanting to present myself as a local. My primary reason for being a local is to avoid the suspicion associated with presenting an out-of-state ID. If the ID is from a neighboring state, it's probably not an issue. However, if I'm presenting a Washington state ID to some remote destination which is not known for its tourism, it's going to raise some red flags. There are a few places who do not send any mail out of state. This might mean they're willing to send mail to someone who lives 200 miles to the east in the same state, but won't send mail to someone 50 miles to the south in a neighboring state. To avoid the potential of getting burned by such nonsense marketing principles, I usually prefer to have a mailing address in the same state as the casino."
Yeah, it makes sense. And I agree. It's always a problem when you're in the middle of Iowa, in the middle of winter, and your ID says Las Vegas. What the heck are you doing there? You got to have some excuse. Now, I would never show a Vegas ID anyway, but...
You're going to come here to gamble? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, so you got to, you know, my aunt died, I'm in town for the funeral, whatever your story is, you got to have some plausible story. But the other thing is, your passport doesn't have an address on it, so you can be from anywhere if you have a passport. And if you play as a refusal, as I do, then you don't have that issue at all. You can say you're from anywhere.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people look at me when I show Vegas ID. I'm one of these people who only have one ID. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Well, but you have a passport.
I do have a passport, but in video poker, you need something with your address on it to get a player's card. Because at most situations, if you don't have a player's card, you just cannot get an advantage at video poker.
No, but if you go... you could easily get a P.O. box and use that address locally and then show a passport and you'd be fine.
Yep. Very good. So we are going to take a commercial break now and we'll be back shortly.
South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In February, there's a $600,000 Crazy Cupid's Money Madness. There will be two casino-wide progressives going at all times. One will start at $10,000 and must be hit before $25,000. In addition to the lucky winner, anyone playing when this jackpot goes off receives $25 in free play. The smaller jackpot begins at $1,000 and must be hit prior to $2,500. The smaller jackpot averages going off three times a day. On Monday, February 19th, President's Day, there will be double points all day, meaning 0.6%, midnight to midnight, no limits on video poker. Slots and real players receive 5x points, which means 1.5%. The sixth week of free video poker classes for this semester, Tuesday, February 13th, beginning at noon in the Silverado Lounge, is 9-6 double-double bonus Ultimate X 10 play. This is a 10-coin per line game where your multipliers this hand depend on what scores you received last hand. Multipliers range from nothing, meaning 1x, to 12x if you get the full house. The variance of this game is quite high, and so is the return. You have a theoretical advantage 24/7 at the South Point, even more so if you do so on multiple point day. Class is free, and if you're at least 21 years of age, you're invited. Silverado Lounge is the first one you come to once you reach the casino from the parking elevators. At videopoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the game. The game of the week is Face Card Frenzy, a new game that gives you extra bonuses for aces, kings, queens, and jacks. It's a 10 coins per line game or a 6 coins per line game, but the 10 coin per line game pays about 0.5% more. A very good analysis of this game was penned on the videopoker.com forum by a man whose handle is Alpax. If you're considering playing this game, by all means check out Alpax's post on the subject. One of the things that Alpax's post cover is how to use video poker for winners to analyze this game.
All right, we're back. So, Richard, in the early going of our last show that we did together, there was a question about Stadium Blackjack game. I don't know what that means.
So a lot of the casinos, I think this started in Macau first, but a lot of the casinos have moved to what they call stadium games, where they basically will have a, say, a blackjack table or a baccarat table or a roulette wheel and a stadium around it where they might put, you know, dozens of people, 50, 100 people around it, and you have a terminal where you can bet, you know, from wherever you are. Now, in blackjack, I'm not quite sure how that works because
somebody has to make the decision.
Right. So I don't know if you're betting on whoever's seated in a particular chair or I don't know. But, you know, with baccarat roulette, obviously, it's easy to just bet on the terminal on whatever you want. So it's a way for the casinos to save money. You know, they can replace, you know, 10 dealers with one or whatever.
And it's more social. It's like everybody cheers or boos or at the same, like in a sports book where you're going to have people on both sides and whatever happens, somebody's cheering.
Yeah, not really. In my experience, you know, people tend to just kind of get lost in their own terminal. There's more interaction when you're seated at a table with somebody, I think.
Oh, okay. Now, several months ago, I told the story of a player who wished to be mentored by me, and what I did was make him buy software and two winner's guides and study significantly on his own before I would spend time mentoring him. He recently wrote back with an update. He said, "I took Bob's advice and studied the Video Poker Winner's Guides and practiced on Video Poker for Winner software for Jacks Are Better and also NSU Deuces Wild. I probably spent at least 100 hours each doing both of these. I was able to play 600 to 700 hands per hour at the advanced level with very, very few errors. By playing video poker at a Caesars property, I achieved 7-star status. Since I got 7-star status, I've been receiving lots of comps at both Caesars and non-Caesars properties. The non-Caesars casino think I'm a gambler based on my 7-star status, so they tend to extend me comps just to get me there to try them out. I might have been able to take advantage of even more comps if I had not gotten injured on military duty, and that slowed me down a little bit. Some of the comps I've gotten include free flights to casino location, free hotel stays, free food, free shows, free box seats at sporting events, and also various cruises where all I have to do is pay port fees and government taxes. And of course, free bets, match plays, and free slot play. Since my 7-star status is valid through January 2019, I probably won't reestablish my 7-star until sometime in 2019 in order to extend it through January of 2021. Since I don't live in Las Vegas or anywhere near a casino, when I do go to a casino, I tend to play blackjack where I can get away with it. Does not play blackjack at the same places he plays video poker. My personal comment to this player is now he's ready for mentoring if he wants to go that route, although he clearly has successfully found his own way. Mentoring at this stage might include why playing at this property or that property might be a better idea. This is an entirely different conversation than learning the times in NSU where you hold deuce 4-5 and when you just hold the deuce.
Yeah, it would be difficult, I would think, because so much of video poker is dependent on the casinos that you have convenient to you. And if you don't live in that area, you may have no idea, you know. So I think it's hard to mentor somebody, even if they live in the same area. I mean, obviously, it'd be easier if they lived here.
Yeah, if they lived in Vegas, although it would help if they're not so young, because there are a lot of senior events that I take advantage of. And were it not for senior events at some of these properties, I would not play there as much as I do. So,
right.
So young people, I have less to tell you, or less to sell you, something like that. All right, here's a question for Richard. An emailer says, I'm a blackjack AP, and I have a girlfriend who is by no means an AP. She is, however, well known to area casinos as a medium to high roller degenerate gambler. So, to avoid heat, we've been having her play at a nearby slot machine. Well, I table bet minimum, and she comes to play after I signal her. And she bets at or near table max with my money, and I give her a cut when we win. This has worked very well for us. We're up $80,000 so far doing this in the past 4 months. How long do you think we'll be able to get away with this? And do you think this is generally a good idea, Richard?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. You know, the best big player you can have is one who's already established as a degenerate and a loser. So you have the ideal big player. I mean, the only thing you could say that would make this better is if you told me your girlfriend is Chinese and has a Chinese passport.
And is hot.
Well... so no, I think you've got exactly the right approach. When we've tried to do these kind of things, some of the problems that you might run into is often these players want to deduct their losses on the slot machine while they were waiting to come play on the blackjack table and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that's your personal relationship. I'll leave that to you to work out that aspect of it, but that sometimes can be a problem. The other thing that you want to make sure of is you say you give her a percentage of the win. You could be giving away all of your edge if you're giving her too much. And if it is not based on sort of a longer period of time as opposed to each session. So there's an article by James Grosjean well, it's a chapter in his book, Exhibit CAA, but it might have been published somewhere else about, you know, what is a free roll worth? What can you legitimately give someone if they're only taking a percentage of the win and none of the loss? But I suspect it's much lower than what you might think. So unless you base it on a certain number of hours of play or something like that. Anyway, I think you're approaching it absolutely the right way in terms of how you're laying it down. And it'll last however long it lasts. But I would say go for it. That sounds like a great opportunity.
Assuming he has other friends who are APs, would it make sense that sometimes she goes plays at a table where they're at instead of him, so they don't notice that whenever she comes, this redhead guy is always at the corner?
Well, I'm assuming they know that it's his girlfriend. I mean, now if they're trying to do this as if they don't know each other, I don't think that's going to fly for very long. I mean, I think they're going to realize you're together. And I think it's better that they know that sooner rather than later, because it doesn't look like you're trying to hide anything. But, it would look, if they start to get suspicious of her, it would look better if she sometimes lands on other people's tables. But then you have to come up with a whole nother scheme for splitting the money with the added person. I would just stick with what you're doing. And,
all right.
Continue to make hay while the sun is shining.
And here's a question for me. This somebody wrote, my question is regarding how each hand is drawn on video poker. As luck, I seem to have run better on simulators and trainers. Is there anything that says a casino has to deal from a virtual random deck? I know that this is the expectation, but are some machines dealt with a random generator where garbage hands are dealt more often than random on winning hands? Maybe I'm being a conspiracy theorist, but I see nothing on the machines that says hands are dealt completely randomly from one deck or any law that the casino has to do it this way. All right. First of all, if you're using the Video Poker for Winners software, there's a setting in the training style section called Level of Difficulty. If you've clicked on the beginner, you're going to be dealt some pretty easy hands and your score will balloon. If you're playing on this level all the time, you are going to think that your score going up, 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 up is the new normal. And when you go into a casino and just get typical results, it's going to feel bad. If you clicked on mix, that's truly random, and that simulates what you'll find in casinos. For me, I click advanced. These are harder than average hands. And so generally on advanced, your score is going to go down, down, down. The fact that my score goes down, down, down is irrelevant to me. What my score is in the training session is not a payoff window. And I want to get practice on the hands that could really give me trouble. So in most jurisdictions, video poker machines are dealt randomly. Two notable exceptions are the state of Washington and the racinos in New York State. If you're not playing there, you're very likely going to get a fair deal. We have one last question for Richard. It has to do with Richard frequently has said that the first step in becoming a card counter is to memorize basic strategy backwards and forwards. Wouldn't simply using a basic strategy card help the beginner make sure basic strategy is being followed and possibly provide some level of cover against heat?
Well, it definitely will not provide cover against heat. And I have seen bosses give players heat for using a basic strategy card, which is ridiculous because often they're selling them in the gift shop. But no, if you don't know basic strategy backwards and forwards and in your sleep, that's the rest of the quote, I don't believe that you can count cards. I mean, it's not that hard to memorize basic strategy. And if you can't accomplish that, I don't think you can accomplish being able to count cards. So that has to be just automatic so you can focus on the counting of cards and calculating how much of the deck is left for sizing your bet. And there are a million distractions in the casino. So if you find it difficult to memorize basic strategy, I would suggest that maybe counting cards is not for you.
Very good. So thank you, Richard. This has been fun. We're closing off for today, but we are going to have more of these Bob and Richard's email sessions in the future. So continue to send us emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com.
Or you can post them on the Facebook page, facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or Twitter is @RWM21. So yeah, we always encourage your questions. Send them on in.
So thank you very much. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.